it's much better to arrive as a team. It's more meaningful when you can take people with you.
Hey everybody, welcome to Identity Unveiled. We are a lifestyle platform that talks about career, beauty, health, and to help support the advancement of Asian American women to the executive ranks.
Our special guest today is Mary Ling Yu with Backstop Solutions Group. It is a privately held software platform company providing cutting edge software to hedge funds, funds of funds, endowments, and other institutional investors. It was founded in 2003, and it is one of the fastest growing software providers in the financial services industry, with 5 global offices serving clients across the United States, Europe, and Asia. And it's been repeatedly recognized by industry leading managers and service providers as a top technology provider in the alternative asset management field. And leading their marketing operations is Chief Marketing Officer Mary Ling Yu. And, you know, I was reading about you, and one of the things that was really fascinating was you said that, you know, you are just as nearly fanatical about content creation, and you love being able to demonstrate that marketing's ROI to CEO and CFO. So you really take being Chief Marketing Officer to heart. You have a channel with over 26,000, YouTube channel with over 26,000 subscribers. Yeah. Now, I got to ask though, where did your fanaticism with content creation and marketing start?
I think I'm a storyteller. You know, I like to tell stories, and I think people respond to stories. You know, they don't respond to this, here's who we are, this is what we sell, you know, this is why you should buy, you know, our product. I think they need to feel an emotional connection, and the best way to create an emotional connection with your audience is storytelling. And then I think it also started with the need for a lot of marketers to tie our efforts to the company's overall revenue goals. It had been a struggle over the years, and it's not acceptable anymore to just say, oh, well, we got this many visits to the webpage, or this many, you know, pieces of audience engagement, or we met this many people, we threw it over the fence at sales. And we don't know, you know, what sales has done with our efforts. And that sort of blaming is, you know, really passe. You really have to be able to show, like, hey, these are the marketing efforts. We held up, you know, for example, 68% of our company's pipeline, and 55% of our company's new revenue is coming from marketing efforts, or we're sourced by marketing. You need to be able to say things like that. In order to say things like that, you need to produce engagement with your audience. In order to get your audience engaged, you have to have great content. And in order to have great content, you have to have great storytelling. So it's all sort of domino in a row.
So let me ask you about this path to becoming a chief marketing officer, how you managed failure and what you did to manage that.
I think the first failure that I had was the failure to understand myself and looking for who I ought to be in the wrong places, looking for it from other people. So as an example, I went to Stanford Business School. I noticed that my classmates would always carry a Wall Street Journal with them. And I never read the Wall Street Journal. And I was never interested in reading the Wall Street Journal. But because I saw everyone carrying it, I was like, well, shoot, I must be missing something. So I subscribed and I started carrying one under my arm. But did I ever read it? No. It was just to sort of fit in. My classmates went into things like finance or venture capital or, you know, trading. And so I thought, well, I'll do that, because I didn't know, you know, I'd come out of management consulting, so I knew what that was about, but I didn't know anything on the finance, trading, or investment banking side. So I went into trading. I started out at Chase Manhattan Bank, which is now, of course, JP Morgan Chase. I started out trading foreign currency derivatives at the time it was called the exotic currency desk. It was changed to emerging markets. So I started off there. Then I looked around and saw my classmates are doing great in dot-coms and startups. This was around 1999. And so I was like, well, I want to go do a dot-com or startup, right? So why can't I hit it big the way they have? So I joined a voice over IP soft switch company back in the year 2000. And, you know, if you remember, like, that's a little late, because that was right around where the bubble started to burst.
Right,
yes.
Right.
So, did about 4 years of that, and then behaved probably like the worst diva ever, that you could ever imagine in those 4 years. Really, really arrogant, really full of hubris. When I think about some of the things that I've said and done, I am just so embarrassed. It's like cringe. It's cringy. It's cringeworthy. If you want a story, I once stepped into our VP of sales's office and I threw a binder across the room. And I basically was upset because he had asked me to do work that I considered beneath me. And I said something to the effect of, oh, well, I'm an MBA from Stanford. I'm like a general, and you're asking me to go do the work of, you know, a sergeant, essentially is what I said. So yeah, that kind of stuff. Hmm. So then I sat there and wondered, well, why am I not being promoted to, you know, lead all of marketing? And it was, you know, again, a failure to understand what leadership is really about. Mm-hmm. And it's not about yourself. It's not about attention for yourself. It's really about serving your team, mm-hmm. you know, pointing them in the right direction, and then serving them by guiding them, clearing obstacles, helping them, steering them towards, you know, where you want them to go, unlocking, you know, pushing them to be their best. But it is, you know, not about yourself. So it was a failure to understand that. At the end of that, I decided, you know what? I'm really smart. I could just go start my own business. I could go buy my own business. So my best friend from business school and I decided to buy a day spa. And it was called Pavia Day Spa. It was in Saratoga, California. And I had it for 7 years. And it was the most spectacular financial failure of my life. Let's just say that on the day I closed it down, I was far worse off than I was graduating high school as a teenager, except that on the day I closed it down, I was like 38 years old and about to give birth. So it was the year 2010, and you'll remember what happened in 2008. Okay, so let me recount, let me go back a bit. The first 3 years of the spa kind of fueled my arrogance, where I thought, oh, I'm really good at this, because first 3 years were a hockey stick. You know, we had doubled our revenues within 3 years. And then 2007 came along, and already I started to see a little bit of softness in the revenues. And I thought, oh, this is because I lost, you know, my best esthetician. She left us and went to start a competing property. But by like middle to end of 2007, I thought, you know what, something is wrong. And I should have looked into selling then. Then of course, 2008 happened, the crash. Our revenues probably cratered by 50%, by half. It got to the point where it was as bad as when we first acquired it. So, you know, what I would do is I took out all of my personal savings. I borrowed, maxed out on business credit cards, and then I got a second job. So what I did was Monday through Friday, I would work at a company called NetApp. I would walk into NetApp and I would work there as a contractor. Mm-hmm. I was contracted by Brocade, paid by an agency called Stage 4 Solutions to work at NetApp to market Brocade's products through NetApp. And I would take all of my salary and I would basically plow it back into the spa. I'll never forget how bad things were. But yeah, I would pawn like heirlooms, things I treasured, my entire salary, my entire savings. Yeah, I know what it is to live, you know, below subsistence. And I had to do it for 7 years. So anyway, then came the downturn 2008. The landlord made an agreement with me. He said, how about this? You pay me month to month, until I can find a new tenant and you, or until you can find a buyer for your spa. Mm-hmm. So it was in 2010 where I got a letter saying, hey, we found a tenant and we'd like you to vacate. At which point I went into 2 weeks of nonstop, like crying. My husband's like, wait, why are you upset? This thing has been like an albatross hanging around your neck. And now you get to, you know, not have any obligations. And plus you're pregnant. Why are you upset? And the reason I was upset, honestly, was, you know, I had all these customers and I had these employees. And I didn't want to have my employees be out on the street. And I didn't want to disappoint my customers who, you know, you build up a pretty big gift card liability, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of spas, what they'll do is they'll just shut their doors and then they just won't pay anyone. You know, they won't tell anyone that here's a way to redeem your gift cards, nothing.
Right.
So I was really afraid to leave my customers.
You felt that accountability, right?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
So I went and struck a deal with a spa down the street. And I said, will you, one, take any employee who wants a job? And will you, two, take on the gift card liability? It could be good marketing for you. You know, once they come and try your spa, you know, they might like it. And they agreed. So those two things were lifted. And then I remember like we had to be out by June 30th. And so I was 8 months pregnant at night, waddling back and forth to the dumpster around 11 o'clock at night, just trying to clear everything out of the spa. And I just remembered like saying, like, I was tired. It was probably one of the hardest times of my life. After closing down the spa, I got state of California sent me a bill and said, hey, you owe $10,000 in sales tax. So you've got to pay it. So, had to work to come up with the money for that, you know, splitting it with my business partner. So what did I do? I gave birth. I got a full-time job and, I went to work 40 hours a week and I just slowly just chipped away at it, until it was gone. It took me a long time, but it's finally gone. And I'm super grateful. I came out a very different person, right? Than I went in. I went in as a diva and I came out threshed and humbled. I learned very much how to listen. But when I came out, you know, because I had that different perspective, I would say that that has really set the stage for my climb out of number one, that subsistence level of living, and two, up the ranks in corporate America, because I think I'd finally learned what leadership meant and that it meant to serve your team. And so I was better at that. So gone was the hubris, gone was the arrogance, gone was the overwhelming confidence that, you know, like, yeah, I've got this. You know, I go into situations now with a much more like, well, I don't know if I've got this.
And I think you also just had, I know, and also just credit to you that you had that self-awareness to see that, to see kind of, to see those learnings outside of what was probably some very dark moments in, you know, your business not doing as you expected it to, having to sell your sapphires. I mean, those are all pretty kind of traumatic events that you know, you came out of really a better sense of self, with a better sense of self. So, you know, credit to you that you had that awareness to see that.
Thank you.
So relationships are an important factor in our journey and our ascent to the top and to becoming kind of the executives, the women that we've talked to. I think they talk a lot about kind of key relationships. So I'm curious about what relationships, whether it's mentors, friends, nannies, you know, who do you attribute to helping you become who you are today as a chief marketing officer?
You know, my first full-time job out of that spa era was with a company called SunGard Availability Services. And you have to understand that this was a company that was, you know, declining in revenue. And when that's happening, there's a lot of attrition. And as people leave, the people who are still remaining get opportunity, you know, sort of like battlefield promotions. So I remember a vice president of marketing that I reported to named Christine Nornberger, who's the CMO of a fintech company today. And she was just so bright and so fierce and so determined. She was not afraid to break glass in any way. And I remember, you know, her as a good mentor and model for me, you know, sort of this fearless mentality. I saw how protective she was of me and her team as well, like a mama bear. And that was where I first thought, yeah, okay, it's important to be protective of your team. You know, internally, she would definitely challenge us and we would have these agreements, disagreements. Externally, she was very, you know, protective. And then she was the one who had me take on digital marketing and strategy, I think within about 9 months of my joining there. And then after that, I was asked to take on demand generation as a whole. And then after that, I got my first VP of marketing job outside. I would say nowadays, the person, you know, that I most look up to now, I don't know if I had anybody really sort of help me and share with me like, hey, this is what you want to say. This is what you don't want to say. These are the things that here are the political minefields or anything like that. I don't think I've ever had like a mentor in that way or a sponsor in that way. So I'm not sure. And that's why I focus now so much on sending the elevator back down for others, because it shouldn't be, it was pretty hard for me. It shouldn't really be that hard, you know? Right. It should be easier for other people. At least I hope it is. Yeah. I don't want them to go through what I had to learn the hard way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's one of the reasons why we do this show is because, you know, growing up, I didn't really have anyone, you know, visibly my mentor. It was really kind of looking at, and definitely not women who looked like me.
Right.
So it was really like you see somebody and you like what they're doing and you see the response of what they're doing. Okay, I want to emulate that. And so there really wasn't just this, it was hard to find people. And you're right, it shouldn't be that hard.
Right. It really shouldn't be. I am very grateful to my current CEO. You know, he's the one who he hired me on as VP of marketing. He promoted me to CMO. You know, I have a seat at his table. I'm a member of the EMC, which is the Executive Management Committee. And, you know, I feel like a trusted business partner of his. And for that, I'm very grateful to have a seat at the table. He also supported me through some tough times in health, where, you know, a lot of companies aren't helpful that way. They're sort of like, oh, you have a cancer diagnosis. Well, let me put you on leave and then pressure you to come back, kind of thing. So I think I'm also just very lucky in a position where I can have impact and in a good company culture. I think that counts a lot too.
Today we're in this period that I like to call, I know it's commonly referred to as a great resignation. Mm-hmm. I like to think it's really a period called the great reassessment.
Yes.
People are really thinking about what's important to them and making changes and how they live and lead their lives. How has the pandemic changed your outlook on life and how you approach work?
You know, it's so funny because I was a 5-day in the office person prior to the pandemic. And right when it started, I was really upset and lamenting not being able to see people in the office, in person, not being able to travel. And pretty soon after that, I would say within 3-4 months, I was completely the other way. I loved being able to walk my daughter to school in the morning, pick her up in the afternoon, spend evenings with her. It gave me back so much time with my family. I will always be grateful that I got to be here, you know, these years, you know, for example, helping her prepare for the spelling bee, the district spelling bee, the county spelling bee, things that I really wouldn't have been able to have time for, you know, in the past. So that's how it has, how I viewed it personally. In terms of professionally, I had to learn to deal with Zoom fatigue, you know, the meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting on Zoom. But I figured out how to do it, which is essentially for me, just stick a 10-minute buffer between meetings so you can like answer the call of nature and things like that. I also had more time to really look at myself. And I think it's important, like we talked earlier about comparison and how my life has really been fueled a lot by comparison and what others were doing. And I realized that the basis of that comparison is a sense of wanting, right? You just want what others have. And so you put yourself into this race of trying to get what others have, when really it's just better to want what you have, what you already have, you know? And I think I've been reflecting on that lately, which is, okay, yeah, it's important to keep up my exercise and keep up on my mental health, but it's also important to just let my soul be quiet and free of want and just sit there. And then it has, I will say, it has turned me towards gratitude for the road that I've walked, which has not been easy. if you look at the story of my life, there are several bottoms. And I can look back on that now and say, yeah, I had to walk through that valley in order to get to where I am today. And
also having a cancer survivor.
Yes, I am. I'm a cancer survivor. It's been 4 years now of I would say triumph over cancer. It's knock on wood. yeah. So just it, I guess overarchingly, the pandemic has turned me towards gratitude and just the sense of awe that I've had, the life that I've had. And that, you know, what other people, like my daughter, she wrote me that Mother's Day card that said, "Mommy, you've been knocked down a lot." And then in parentheses, like a lot. what other people may see as that, you know, I don't necessarily see that anymore. Yes, in the moment I experienced them as being knocked down, you know, being diagnosed with cancer was definitely like a punch to the gut. But looking back on the journey, I can say that I'm really grateful that that happened and that I wouldn't change it for the world.
I want to turn just very quickly to about, you know, being an Asian woman and how your Asian culture has played a part in your leadership. How do you think that, you know, given your ethnic background, how do you think that's been a factor and influenced you in how you lead and how you've managed through those ups and downs?
My parents were immigrants. So they were Chinese American immigrants. My father came here to take on a PhD, and my mother came here to essentially be with him. There's a phrase in Chinese that's pei du, which literally means like, I'm going to just sit there and be with someone who's studying. When my mom got here, though, she kind of saw an opportunity for a new life. So she kind of threw herself into new businesses. You know, first she started off accounting, which was her background. Then she decided, you know, to become a jewelry designer. I'm not that different from other people of my generation with tiger parents. I will say that I think my parents were maybe a lot more tiger than tiger parents. I think they make other people's parents look like pussycat parents. It was a very strict household. We couldn't talk back. We couldn't show we were frustrated or angry at our parents. And it was, you know, it was abusive. And I remember approaching my dad once about why he would think it was okay to, you know, beat up on my mother. And his response was, there's a Chinese phrase, it's always a Chinese phrase, but the Chinese phrase is rou nen ke gang, which means silk can cut iron. And so what he was saying to me was, if you want to get your point across, you have to approach me a certain way as the woman. You have to, you know, come at me from an underhand perspective, like with finesse. if you try to impose who you are on me, I am not going to respond well. You know, that's one area where meekness comes from as an Asian woman, is that. The second area is that I grew up, you know, I grew up in Atlanta and Savannah, as I mentioned. Around 9 years old, we moved up to a suburb of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And, you know, this was 1981. There was probably not a day that went by where I didn't experience some form of racism. I would go home and I would tell my parents this, and their advice was just ignore it. It'll go away. So it was this, I think it's dual. I think it's one, there's a certain way that women need to behave around men, mm-hmm. right? If we want to get our way, right. It's not through force, it's through meekness. Two, if people abuse you or commit microaggressions against you, you should just be silent because it'll go away. Mm-hmm. I think that those were two factors for me, definitely growing up. And in terms of answering your question on how does that impact the way I lead, I don't know that it really does, because I don't know if I really am meek.
Do you find yourself, though, as you have progressed on, you know, to become now this executive woman, this chief marketing officer, do you feel yourself still, you know, when you think about those characteristics that you define, that haven't kind of, that you've grown up around, you grew up with, do you still feel yourself being meek? Do you still feel yourself, you know, respecting authority? Are those pieces still showing up in how you've progressed to become now this executive woman?
I would like to say to you, no, I've totally transcended all that. But I think the truth, if I reflect, is maybe not entirely. I do find myself, you know, just kind of nodding my head reflexively sometimes, even if I'm not in complete agreement, right, with someone. I do find that when I have learned to be extremely straightforward and direct and just to say something straight out. So whatever message you're trying to deliver, just deliver it in a neutral tone. Mm-hmm. I find that works for me, and it causes people to listen versus, you know, if I'm coming from a place of emotion or passion about something.
So what do you think got you to where you are today?
Well, I think some of it is being in the right place at the right time. You know, remember I was talking about the company that had the declining revenues and having these, I had two battlefield promotions where I was like promoted to lead one team and then to another. And all of a sudden it was like right under a VP role. And then the next, you know, transitioning to a VP role was not that hard. So I think it was just someone taking a chance on me, was being in the right place at the right time and someone being willing to take a chance on me. I think that's the first thing. But why were they willing to take a chance on me? So I had one job and I was pretty vocal about, you know, certain things I was passionate about, like, for example, search engine optimization and search engine marketing, and that I knew something about from my days of running a spa. And I would kind of bring that forward into my role. And it was a little bit non-traditional. And I think because of that, you know, my VP of marketing thought, she has some knowledge around this area. And, you know, she talks about it in a cogent way. Why don't I give her a chance to lead this area? So I think it's like bringing your whole self and experience to a role and being unafraid to share sort of everything you know. And then three, you know, what's interesting is that I got to CMO from VP of marketing, you know, first of all, by number one, demonstrating that marketing can concretely contribute to revenue. But then I think number two is building a really high performance team. So when I go to hire people, I look for people who are smarter than I am. And I look for people who are smarter, who have the work ethic, and who I think are a good addition to our culture. Even if they're not a fit, I like it if they're additive, right? And who come from a background that I don't necessarily have. and who have grit. I think the grit part is super important. And I really admire that. And so then I sort of bring them together, and then I invest a lot. I am not afraid to invest in them, you know, this certification, that certification, you go to this summit. I'm going to get you a $35,000 a year subscription to Forrester, where you can really dig deep into, you know, your area of marketing, customer marketing, retention marketing. Well, that's really the same thing. Portfolio marketing or marketing operations. And then I'm also not afraid to promote them when I think that they've hit a certain level. I'm just like, okay, it's time to promote her. Mm-hmm. And so I think that builds like a really strong and loyal culture. And I also think that, you know, I'm also not afraid to give others credit and let them have the laurels, because that recognition is what causes them to have a career boost. So what I see my role as is I'm a trainer of future CMOs. And I'm not afraid to kick someone out the door either, to say, listen, you need to go elsewhere to move up, or you need to go elsewhere to learn this lesson, or you need to go be a CMO somewhere else. You know, you need to, and I absolutely will. I see this current crop of VPs that I have, the next layer beneath me, as people that I'm probably going to work for someday. So yeah, I hire people that I want to work for. That's essentially, I think, been the secret.
So speaking of the future, what advice would you have for her? She one day graduates from school, takes her first job, and hopefully becomes the next Asian American woman executive.
The other night we had this conversation where she said, "Mommy, I'm out for me and you're always out for others." You're always out for other people. Like, you give away things. But I would have just kept it all for myself, you know? And so what I did say to her was, well, if you want to be a leader in life, and you have to think of yourself as a servant first and foremost. So not being out for yourself all the time and always, you know, looking out for those people that are on your team, that you want to bring along with you. So there's this old phrase that I really like. It's something like, if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to get somewhere, what was the other? It's go together. What is that phrase?
Yeah, I'm going to have to Google that one, but I know what you're referring to. So it's about like not going at it alone.
Right. It's about not going at it alone.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, if you want to go fast, then go alone by yourself. But if you want to get there successfully, I guess it's go together. I was trying to instill in her the importance of teamwork and collaboration, how it never, going it alone is one way in life, but it's very lonely. It's much better to arrive as a team, and then it's more shared. It's more of a triumph. It's more meaningful when you can take people with you.
We are so fortunate to have you on our show today. Thank you for being so candid and open about your story. It truly is very inspiring. And I love the honesty that you bring to where you are now and really what that journey has been and what it's like right now. Be sure to connect with us at Identity Unveiled on our social media platforms. You can also learn more about us on our website at www.identityunveiled.com. Look forward to seeing you next time.